it. Could we start by asking you what happened in the railway carriage with Christabel Pankhurst?
Oh, I found myself staying in the same hotel in Switzerland, and got friendly, as one does in Swiss hotels, with a party of which Christabel Pankhurst was a member. And I stayed on a little after my party, and Christabel stayed on a little after her party. And I got the impression that Christabel was a life gracious living, you know. She never went to prison more than once, no. Mm. And I just got the impression that she was frightfully interested in food. I rather unfortunately had some something sandwiches, I don't know what it was, which I put in a hot place. They weren't as edible as they should have been when we came to unpack them.
Yes.
And Christabel took it harder than normally I think one should.
So you just think that the...
And we also, she insisted on having a very good supper in the hotel in Lucerne before we entered our long train journey.
Yes. So how do you think she measures up to how she's portrayed in the Shoulder to Shoulder? And do you think they've got her right?
I think they've got her pretty well, because it's quite obvious that Mrs. Pankhurst adored her and spoilt her, really, and was dominated by her to some extent. But of course, Mrs. Pankhurst was a spellbinder. Mm.
Yes, you mentioned, I'll put this out of the way, you mentioned that you saw her, you went to Lincoln's Inn, as far as I remember.
I once had lunch with her.
Yes, and you said it was a memorable experience.
But it was for me, you see. I mean, I was very young at the time.
Yes.
And she was a great woman. I think she was a great woman. She had shot her bolt by 14, and she was an emotionally unstable woman.
Mm.
And there's rather thing, one thing that's rather well done, Shoulder to Shoulder.
Mm.
You may remember there's a point at which she suddenly finds that she can hold an audience, and suggests that she felt a sense of power at that moment.
Mm. Yes, there was an incident last week, wasn't there? I don't know if you saw it, where everything's focused on her face while
yes.
she's talking.
And I thought she was very well cast.
I agree with that, yes, as my
impression. Unlike Bannister's.
Yes, yes. But when you actually went to see her, how did she behave to you? I mean, did she try and make you...
She was kind to me and gracious, and she was at that time living at the Inns of Court Hotel, because she didn't otherwise had no settled home.
Extraordinary life she had, really, didn't she? I mean, she was living from...
Beginning with the Independent Labour Party in Keir Hardie,
yes.
and ending up with a munitions campaign for Lloyd George, and that rather hysterical campaign on behalf of Yugoslavia.
Yes, I agree. But Christabel, you see, I mean, I don't know whether you ever saw Christabel, did you?
Oh, yes, time and again.
I mean, apart from your rail journey with her.
Oh, yes. I used to see her in public because I used to attend their meetings.
Mm.
The thing that Shoulder to Shoulder might have staged and had some fun with was the occasion when there was a Trafalgar Square demonstration of suffragists, and some members of Parliament, inspired by curiosity, went out into Trafalgar Square to see what was happening. And among those who did were Mr. Lloyd George and the Home Secretary, Herbert Gladstone, I think it was. And Christabel saw them. And when she was put on trial for creating a disturbance, called them as witnesses. And it was a very piquant occasion, you see. Christabel, who was a good lawyer, really, had taken a law degree in Manchester University, had these two men at her mercy in the witness box. And, of course, it was wonderful headline news.
Were you actually there?
No, I wasn't. No, I wasn't there.
Yes, yes. I've read about that.
Yeah.
With Christabel, I mean, I find her a very puzzling person because she is most attractive to look at.
She was. Attractive speaker. Good wonderful repartee.
Yes, yes. And yet, there's this sort of element of hardness in her, which I'm sure did exist, and which comes
over the shoulder. And after that, she did very odd things. She became went off to America and became a sort of evangelical preacher.
Yes.
She was. She had a bit of her mother's unbalance, I think, but none of her mother's inexpressible dignity and dignity and charm.
Yes, her manner when speaking would be a sort of gay rapport with her.
Yes, I think it would.
Not a sort of dignified performance in any sense.
And she determined that she was not going to prison again.
Yes.
She hadn't that sort of heroic dedication that Mrs. Bankhurst had.
You think what she was really interested in was speaking, I mean, holding
Yes,
audience.
I think she was.
And this is the
And herself and her own comfort.
And this is the thread that runs through her life, in a sense.
And the way they treated the Bethick Lawrences was beyond belief.
Yes, it was very interesting, that incident last week in Shoulder to Shoulder, because you have there the behind-the-scenes discussions with them, which were never published, of course, and which were purely imaginary, I suppose. I mean, they don't
They weren't imaginary, I don't think. Mrs. Bethick Lawrence wrote a sort of autobiography, which I've got there, and I reviewed it. And I referred to their extreme heroism.
Did you? May I ask you where you reviewed it? Because I would like to read it, actually. I've read the biography, but I haven't read your review of it.
I don't even know that I've got it.
I mean, do you remember where it was reviewed?
No, I don't.
Because she's a very interesting person. I think she's well cast, actually.
I think she's well cast.
You know her, but I don't.
You see, she and her husband, when they Bankhursts hit them, they were philanthropists. They ran the West London Mission for girls, which was a big sort of charitable organisation.
Did he?
She was an invalid for a long time.
Yes.
And then lost her wits to some extent.
Had she really? Yes.
And very well.
Yes, I'd like to ask you a bit about him, actually, if I may. Don't worry, I'll look out for it.
I don't know when I reviewed it. I thought there was a letter from her somewhere in it. But it appears to have disappeared.
Shall I have a look and see if I can see it?
It isn't there. If it were there, it would fall out.
Yes. It certainly doesn't seem to be.
No, wait a minute. Yeah, it is.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Marvellous.
Yeah, it is. Dated 25th of April, 1938, from Mrs. Bethick Lawrence at the Old Square, Lincoln's Inn, where they lived. Thank you very much for your beautiful review of my book, My Part in a Changing World, in the Manchester Guardian of last Friday. Which gave very great pleasure to my husband and myself. From the point of view of real insight, yours is much the best review I've had, though I'm glad to say everybody has been most kind and friendly. With very warm appreciation, yours sincerely. Take that date and you'll be able to...
That's very interesting, yes, thank you, I will.
Be able to place it.
Yes. It's the Friday before the 25th of April.
Manchester Guardian.
Thanks, Guardian. Before 25, 38. Because that makes your review doubly interesting if she herself thought it was a fair one.
I knew the thing so much better than most of the people who reviewed that book.
Yes.
So late.
You see, one great disadvantage that one's under working on the suffragette movement and suffragist movement is there's no good biography of Fred Bethick Lawrence. I mean, that Britain book is not a good biography.
It isn't.
I don't think. And I wondered, one thing I would like to ask is did Fred ever talk to you about the suffragette period and his involvement?
Not more than they said in that book.
Yes.
Bankhurst did nothing by halves.
Yes.
Now, I don't know how I got to know Fred again. You see, Emmeline was very much admired for her part in the suffrage movement. And some people were rather critical when Fred married again. You see, as indeed he did rightly, after having nursed Emmeline for a very long time, and he was married very happily. And I think he felt that he was a little criticised for having comforted himself after being mad at so great a woman. And I wrote a letter to him and congratulated him and said how very pleased I was to hear about his marriage. And he wrote back a nice letter. And I said, oh, let's meet, do bring your wife to dinner. And he brought his wife to dinner. She was an old suffragist.
Who was she actually? I ought to know, but I don't.
One of the well-known militants.
Oh, she was in the WSPU,
yes.
Was she?
An old militant. He'd bailed her out, I think, on one occasion.
I was trying to think who it would be. Yes, anyway, I can find that out, can't I?
Yes, it'll be in that book, in his book, I think.
Yes.
It'll
yes.
be in Vera Brittain's book.
Yes, yes, I'll look it up anyway. Anyway, that's interesting.
Anyway, I got in touch with him again.
Yes.
And then on another occasion, we went to a theatre together. And his wife got something wrong with her spine and said she was going to die and proceeded to do so as best she could. But in fact, there was nothing much wrong with her spine. Mm. And she didn't die. In fact, she outlived him.
Mm, I see. Did you see, he come... I mean, it's very difficult to understand how he ticked, because they're rather wealthy philanthropists,
yes,
as you say.
Yes, early public-spirited.
Yes, but yet somehow they don't... there's no flamboyance or character no. much.
Well, they were wonderful money-raisers.
Yes.
You see, at these big Albert Hall meetings they used to have...
Mm.
Money came flowing in.
Mm.
And Mrs. Pethick Lawrence, at that time, was a wonderful money raiser.
Mm.
And she would have a great sort of notice,
sort of Dutch auction.
Yes.
Yeah.
So-and-so check, for so-and-so check,
yeah.
for so-and-so, so-and-so.
Yeah.
And then minutes when the checks stopped flowing in,
yes.
she would say, now we will take the collection.
Yes. Yes. The whole thing...
And Fred operated the machine.
Like a sort of bingo operation.
I suppose so. I've never been to one.
Yes, no, I haven't, but I
but
can
anyway,
imagine it had the attraction.
Fred was very charming and, of course, very proper. And I remember him, you see, he was Secretary for India at the time when Wavell was rather roughly and rudely pushed out by Mountbatten, perhaps rightly. And... he said he thought Wavell had had rather a hard time. And then he just modestly, very modestly, said, you know, Wavell said to me, I apologize for telling this story, he said to me that he took it because if rape is inevitable, relax and enjoy it.
Yes, yes. But what I'm really trying to say is that by comparison with the Pankhursts, Fred Pethick Lawrence doesn't seem to have much individuality.
No, he hasn't.
He seems almost a sort of faceless person.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, presumably he wasn't.
Well, he did all the business side of it, you know.
Yes. But presumably
and
he was.
Edited votes were in.
Hmm. Yes, I mean, I'm sure he was a public spirited and interesting person, but I mean, in
very much a background figure.
Yes, absolutely.
Backroom boy.
What was he like when you knew him? I mean, in private.
Late in life.
Yes.
When I got to know him after this sort of reconciliation over his wife. Oh, he was a little man, clean shaven. He, by that time, joined the Labour Party and was Secretary of India. Whether he was a very effective one, I wouldn't know. But he came in at a very unhappy time, you see, when Wavell was unseated. And he was there for the takeover.
Mm. Mm. And did he have a sense of humour, for instance?
Not much. I don't think any of them had.
Yes. See, that's a curious thing. I mean, you see them when you've got photographs of the WSPU people, they're always enjoying themselves, always laughing and so on. And yet...
it's a great companionship.
Yes, and yet it's said by people, I think probably you among others, that they had no sense of humour.
No,
I mean, how do you reconcile these two?
Well, you know, these great people can't. I mean, Hitler had no sense of humour. The Webbs had no sense of humour.
Mm.
John Reith had no sense of humour.
Mm.
Gladstone, I don't think he had a sense of humour.
Mm.
Ernest Simon certainly hadn't, not a grain.
And yet they're always laughing, always enjoying themselves in the
photographs. Well, you can have a sense of fun and not have a sense of humour.
Yes, I think that is the distinction, really, isn't it?
And Mrs. Fawcett, you see, had a very acute sense of humour.
A sort of wry, quiet, intellectual sense of humour, was it?
I think it was, yes.
Yes, yes.
When we had a... The suffrage movement was blazing when I was a student at the School of Economics, and I and one of my fellow students were joint secretaries of the union, and we had a great back, and we used to have a sort of ornamental president. And we put up Mrs. Fawcett, who was at that time living in Gower Street with her sister and her daughter. And the antis put up Lord Avebury, who was in those days a sort of leading anti-suffragist, but with no other qualifications than the fact that he was a leading anti-suffragist. And we won after a hard internal union strife, and we had Mrs. Fawcett. And unlike most ornamental presidents, she used to come to student meetings. And she gave us an inaugural lecture on the subject of gossip. And it was really very, very amusing.
What was it? Was it ever published, actually?
No, I don't think it was.
What did she say?
Well, I know. She told amusing stories. She told a very nice story of a party which two eminent politicians were expected to be present. And everybody was warned that they would want to talk serious politics to one another. And they were left alone with their heads together talking. And somebody going past heard one of them say to the other, "Then do you think it was his fault or hers?"
Yes. One can't imagine Mrs. Pankhurst telling that sort of joke. Anecdote. No.
No.
Yes. You see,
on another occasion, there was a great meeting of the constitutionals in the Albert Hall. And Lady Henry Somerset was present. And Lady Henry Somerset was a great temperance worker. And Mrs. Fawcett, who was sitting on the platform, was heard to murmur to her neighbour, "If she goes on like this much longer, I shall call for a brandy and soda." Well, yes. Brandy and soda dates it, doesn't it?
Yes, yes, but that's interesting. She seems to have been a very rational, sensible...
Holy. And as I said, someone else, so English.
Mm. Yes, you did, in your commonplace book. Yes, yes. Mm.
I sang it, but I sang my own words.
Yes. Did you... presume you saw quite a lot of her after 1915?
Yes, quite a lot, you see, through the School of Economics and the Union.
That too.
And also because I worked in her, on her executive committee.
Yes, you were on the executive committee for...
At a very early age.
Mm. I mean, in 1915 you first joined it, didn't you?
Yes, I was only just... I got engaged during it.
Yes. Could you tell me, could we go back to your Kensington days, the Rendall connection and all that? Can you explain why you became a suffragist rather than a suffragette?
I didn't like dictatorship. I never could swallow it.
And you knew the WSPU was a dictatorship from the beginning?
Well, it's quite obvious.
Yes, yes.
At a very early stage, at a meeting in the Bethick Lawrence's house, which you can still see. It's a curious house with a sundial on one side of it at Homewood. And in those days it stood alone. And now it's rather surrounded, but if you drive through Homewood, you see it. And on one side of it, it's got a sundial with the words, "Let others tell of storms and showers, I mark the sunny morning hours." Optimistic. But there it is, and you can see it if you drive through Homewood. And it was the Bethick Lawrence's country home when they lived working at the movement in Clement's Inn, and Christabel was always with them. And the first real sign of dictatorship was at a meeting of the WSPU, which had been fairly recently founded, in the Bethick Lawrence's garden. And my aunt Edith Rendall, who had joined the SPU, was there, and it was there that the first split occurred, when Mrs. Pankhurst suddenly tore up the Constitution and said, "No more of this, no more committees." And the body that afterwards became the Women's Freedom League opted out of the movement and remained militant, but had committee.
and elected. I think Mrs. Despard and people like that.
Yes. Actually, that's another neglected organisation, isn't it? I mean, the
NWSS. They were militant, all right, but they were a smaller organisation and much less spectacular.
But as a girl, you knew the contrast between the two organisations.
You couldn't help knowing
it. And you made a rational sort of decision.
You couldn't help knowing it.
It wasn't that you had friends in the NUWSS and that tempted you. It really was a decision of sort of principle, wasn't it?
Well, I think it was. You see, on the whole, the Rendles were a very democratic-minded people. But you couldn't help being stirred by what the militants were doing.
Before you made your decision to join the NUWSS, you had been to some meetings.
I was born in it, so to speak.
Yes.
And because all my relations were in it, you see. The Strachey family ran it. And we were very closely allied with the Stracheys. And we all loved Philippa Strachey, the daughter who ran the London Society.
Yes, can you tell me a bit about her? She's another person. I haven't got any picture of her at all. I mean, what
All was background.
Yes. Rather like Miss Courtney. In fact, do you think all?
Well, Miss Courtney was very prominent as when she was Honorary Secretary, and she pulled out at one point on the peace question with Maud Royden.
But one gets the impression she's a bit of a backroom girl in a way. I mean, that she's not.
She worked very, very closely with Mrs. Fawcett.
Yes, as an office organiser and
As the Honorary Secretary.
I mean, in a way, you feel these aren't the person.
I think I may have a pamphlet about Philippa Strachey.
Have you?
That I was asked to write off.
Oh, that would be great.
With the help of her.
I'd like to. You see, I'm rather ill-informed about what happened to all the suffragists afterwards.
Well, what happened?
And you know.
Ray Strachey's got all that in her book, I think.
Yes, yes, I've read
the National book, Union for Equal Citizenship.
Yes, but I must do some more reading on the later period, I think. But I'd be interested to know where that
pamphlet. Wrote an obituary of her, which was never published. And he showed me a copy of the obituary.
So yours was based to some extent
Mine
on that,
was it? Based to some extent. Well, of course, I knew her very well indeed. Yes. So kind. She's the only person who really
That's very kind of you. Thank you
very much. Sane element in that mad household which Lytton Strachey.
Yes, yes. But you do say in your commonplace book that the family wasn't totally united in being attached to suffragism rather than suffragettism.
I don't think there's any militants in the Strachey family. Oh, the Rendell family, yes, my auntie.
Sorry, in the Rendell family, yes.
And my cousin Lila. Yes.
Yes.
But you know, we cared so much about the movement, it didn't make any difference.
Yes, you say that. I mean, you quite obviously went to quite a lot of suffragette movement, many meetings, didn't you?
We all did.
Yes. I mean, in a way, it's quite wrong to look at the two movements as separate. I mean, they were part of a sort of common...
Well, I think I said somewhere, which was quite true, that in the early days of militancy, in a way, the constitutional movement was parasitic on the militants.
Yes.
Because the fire kindled by the militants and their heroism went to stoke the furnaces of Mrs. Fawcett's organisation. Later on, when militancy became a liability, in a way they were parasitic on us because they were not taken seriously by politicians. And our organisation, you see, was, I mean, it dated from John Stuart Mill, and it had these two wonderful parliamentary secretaries and Eleanor Rathbone, who knew all the dodges about getting civil servants to take notice. All that parliamentary work, the militants couldn't have done. They hadn't experience.
Yes, yes, yes. But you presumably went to some WSPU meetings before you joined the NUWSS.
Oh, no, I joined the NUWSS. All my, I said, I was born in it.
Yes, yes, I see.
They had the first procession.
Yes.
The mud march. Yes. When I was a schoolgirl.
How did you join the NUWSS? Did you join a Kensington branch then, or what? How did it work?
I joined the London Society, which was a large branch.
I see. So it doesn't have a sort of Kensington tentacle.
Well, as a matter of fact, I think my banner that I carried was Kensington.
But you didn't have a sort of local headquarters where you went regularly or anything like that.
The militants had a. No, we did it mostly in London, I think. The militants had a shop. The top of Bedford Gardens, where they sold their literature and sported their colours.
But you actually joined the sort of central London body.
Yes.
And Philippa was running it,
she
in a sense.
She ran it. She was.
Yes.
She was secretary.
How did she run it? She was presumably very good at office work and
tremendously good organiser.
Yes.
And entirely selfless.
Yes.
As she showed in the Strachey family, when they all in various degrees went mad, she was the one that looked after them.
Yes.
She had a softness and a tenderness that most of them didn't have at all.
But she doesn't speak, does she, very much?
She never spoke in public, I think.
Yes.
I don't remember hearing her speak in public.
Mm. And was she the agency by which you got onto the committee, as you say, as a very young...
I got onto the committee by making rather a good speech. When we had that discussion about peace...
In 1950?
Yes, when Maud Royden and Cicely and a dame the other day...
Courtney Ashby was not
in that. No, it was led by Courtney and Maud Royden, both of whom were great internationalists, pacifists, and they wanted the union, which was still a corporate body, you see, in doing its work, to commit itself to a peace policy. And Mrs. Fawcett wasn't going to do that, and nor was Corbett Ashby, nor were most people. But in the debate on whether we should or not, I think I was at that time newly married, it was a very early stage, I made rather a good speech against the peace party. Rather unfair, because poor Maud Royden was suffering from a very bad sick headache at the time. But it was as a result of that speech that they put me on the executive. At a rather early age.
It's interesting. Can you tell me a bit about Dame Kathleen at this stage? Because I've only seen her when she's 97, and
yes.
I can't imagine what she must have been like at that time.
Just the same.
What is the same?
I don't think she's changed at all. She's always been a great internationalist, you know.
Mm. But very diffident about talking about herself. I mean,
oh, yes.
You know, it's very difficult to find.
Now, there was a tremendous big meeting. I didn't go to it because I was busy. I was ill or living in Manchester or something. I forget. To celebrate the... 50th anniversary, and Eleanor Rathbone was in the chair, and the other dame, Courtney, really stole the show by her speech and got a standing ovation.
She wasn't an emotional speaker, I imagine.
No, she wasn't.
She would be rather
very
rational.
Impressive.
Yes.
Yeah. And by that time, you see the breach between the peace party and the non-peace party. Forgiven and forgotten.
Yes, it's rather surprising. I mean, there doesn't seem to have been very much bitterness in that split at all. I mean, Mrs. Swanwick says in her autobiography she still got on well with Mrs. Fawcett afterwards.
Oh, yes.
There was no... I mean, it's really curious.
Mrs. Fawcett was determined not to quarrel with anybody.
Yeah.
Though she did, she was rather sore with Eleanor Rathbone for imposing family allowances on the union.
Yes.
And that caused her to resign. She was very sad. Mm. And very sad for Eleanor.
Yes, it must have been rather painful for everybody.
It was painful for everybody.
Yes. But
Mrs. Fawcett was a dyed-in-the-wool liberal.
Yes. I mean, obviously she conflicts with Eleanor's
yes.
belief in state welfare.
Yes, she did. She was very rather anti-socialist.
Mm. Mm. It surprised me that she came out of her retirement to fight Eleanor on that. I mean, she must have been very old at that stage. And you would have thought
yes,
she...
Yes, I think she was. But she was very fit. And I used to see her walking down Gower Street, rather short steps, slightly bent. And very quick.
That's interesting, yes. But couldn't quite imagine the mood of that conflict over pacifism in 1915. It seems to have been so unviolent or unbitter, and yet it was such a bitter
It was
question.
A bitter conflict. And that was when Mrs. Fawcett said, we'll keep our powder dry. And I made a speech, which did influence the meeting on that.
Mm.
And I began by quoting August Bebel.
Mm.
I said there was a German, very German, a great feminist called August Bebel, and his motto was "Bereit sein ist alles," be ready is everything. And if we don't adopt that motto ourselves now, we're done.
You mean keep together?
Yes.
For women's purposes.
Yes. Mm,
I see. I understand. Let me see. I've got a note somewhere of Eleanor Rathbone's position on that, which is rather interesting. I wonder if I can find it.
She used to give a presidential address during her presidency, and they were collected into a paper bag, I think I probably have it, on political procedure.
Oh, well, that, I would be most interested to read that. I'm afraid I didn't realise that she'd published a thing like that, because
she's
a very shrewd political operator, really, isn't she?
Yes, she was, indeed. And learnt it from her father,
yeah.
Who was a private member of Parliament.
Yes.
Meanwhile, read the inscription inside that cigarette box.
Yes, I will.
annual council meeting of the National Union of Societies for Equal Citizenship, 1920 to 1929.
Yes, well, I must certainly read that.
And the trial of the suffragette leaders, published by the... coming soon, I suppose.
Mm. Well, that's interesting. I certainly... may I borrow them and let you have them back through the post?
As long as you let me have milestones back.
I'll certainly let you have both back as soon as I've finished them. I didn't realise this was published, actually, because her addresses were really very good indeed, I think. But that position that she took in 1915, you see, seems to me a very wise one.
She was a very wise woman.
I mean, clearly there's a case for keeping, as you say, a woman's organisation in existence, in readiness, and for people who want to fight about peace and so on to join other organisations.
Well, that was handed over to me by the family.
Was it?
After I wrote The Life of Her.
Yes, were they happy with it?
Yes, they were happy with it.
Yes.
The person who wasn't happy with it was Gonax.
Said so, why?
Because he wanted to write it himself.
They
wouldn't let him.
Good heavens. Why wouldn't they, actually? Because they didn't think...
Well, they didn't like him. Nor did I, for that matter. But, anyway.
He married a suffragette, of course, didn't he?
He did, indeed. He married a school friend of mine.
Ruth Lowy.
Yes. Yeah. We used to call her Lover.
That's how you pronounce it, is it? I didn't
know that. Well, it changed during the war.
I see.
But it was Lover, L-O-W-E, with...
Yes, there was quite a good obituary of her in the Times the other day.
There was, and so that should be.
Yes.
She's a very good businesswoman.
Yes.
And she did half the work.
Yes.
And now the family have taken it on.
Yes, yes. She was also very wealthy, wasn't she? And the family was very wealthy, the Lowys.
I think they were. They lived when I was at school with her, they lived in one of those enormous houses, you know, in Holland Park, which are now all flats.
Because, you know...
And she was a granddaughter of Lord Swathling, who had that enormous house in Palace Gardens, which is now occupied solely by the Marchioness of Chumley. I think the only private inhabitant in that garden of embassies.
Interesting, because you know, if you look through the subscription list of the WSPU, the Lowys are very prominent, giving large sums of money.
Oh, yes, Ruth's mother did a lot of work.
They were happy, they thought you'd got Eleanor right, so to speak, I mean, in the biography.
Well, I used to be asked, yes, they did, they thought I'd got her right, indeed, I think I did.
I'm sure you did.
But I think that biography is a bit overwritten. If it were ever republished, I could shorten it considerably.
Oh, I would be very sorry if you did.
Yeah.
It seems to me really an excellent biography.
Well, it's from your point of view, it gives the internal affairs of the organisation.
And it gives a picture of the personality, I mean, very brilliantly, I think. I think it's really
interesting. And, of course, her life's companion was Elizabeth McAdam, and was a difficult woman in many ways. And Eleanor was always so anxious that Elizabeth McAdam should do her own work on social science and be recognised in her own right. And I think Elizabeth McAdam was sometimes... You know what? Felt that she was living with a woman much greater than herself.
Yes.
Fortunately, Eleanor died first, because I don't think Eleanor could have lived without Elizabeth. But Elizabeth was able to live quite happily in Edinburgh without Eleanor.
Yes, this really raises a point which I feel, reading about the suffragettes, I know it's not quite a parallel, but you all had servants, didn't you?
Oh, yes, we all did.
And there is an incident in Mrs. Swanwick's autobiography which I noticed. She had a woman called Agnes in Manchester who looked after her, and she says in her autobiography that Agnes said to her, "I can't write and speak myself, but I can set you free to write and speak." Now, it seems to me that Elizabeth McAdam, in a sense, does that for Eleanor Rathbone, doesn't
she? Well,
she
wouldn't
servant,
like me to think so.
But you see my point.
Yes.
Can you explain to me how suffragist activity fits into the existence of servants in the sort of people who lived in Kensington at the time when you joined?
Well, we were the only people who had time.
And that's my feeling.
We didn't have to. If we had aged parents that they were ministered to, and we can do outside work in spite of having them.
So, in fact, in a sense, the whole movement is supported by working women in a double sense. First of all, they join, but secondly, they're enabling you to be active, so to speak.
Yes, really, of course, all, with the exception of the trade union movement and possibly consumers' cooperation, all welfare services and movements for social reform have been introduced and pushed by the intellectual middle classes.
Yes.
Or the aristocracy.
But freed by the servants.
Of course.
Yes, I mean, in a way, probably we lose quite a lot by...
We've lost quite a lot.
...being distracted.
We've lost quite a lot.
But presumably the Straits, you see, and you yourself, were freed for activity in the NWSS by these servants to some extent. Yes. It's interesting. I mean, do you feel that the Labour alignment inside the NUWSS really reflected an actual sympathy with the Labour Party on the part of most of its leaders?
No, I don't think it did, you see. I think most of them were not Labour, but Liberal. And the Election Fighting Fund policy, which was hotly debated and greatly disliked by some of its informants in supporting Labour pro-suffrage members in rather rocky seats. Took some getting through.
Yes, one might almost have expected a split on that issue in 1913.
Well, one might have, but no, we didn't split. We didn't want to split.
Yes, yes.
But Eleanor got into trouble for opposing it after it had been carried by the executive.
I remember you mentioned that, and she rather resented being accused of disloyalty.
Yes, I know. By her own cousin, Margaret Ashton.
Yes, yes. Why did they reject her idea for councils of citizenship in 1913? Remember, she wanted to...
Yes, I can't remember that.
I mean,
1913, before we got the vote.
Yes, it doesn't feature in the Common Cause as a sort of major argument at all.
No. I think we were too concentrated, you know, on the vote. Mm. It really did lose England a lot of good social service, this concentration of middle-class women.
Which the anti, that's the anti-argument.
Asquith was responsible for.
Yes. I mean, the antis always objected, didn't they, on those grounds, that it was really a distraction from the real business of social work, as Octavia Hill
would
have argued.
Octavia Hill, of course, hated any sort of legislative solution of anything. Mm. Mrs. Humphrey Ward was sufficiently influential in her own circle to think that she didn't want the adventitious of the vote. I don't know. She's a strange woman. She was in the House of Commons with Mrs. Fawcett listening to the final, that crucial debate on the suffrage amendment when Lord Curzon ratted.
Yes, they were rather annoyed about that, weren't they?
They were extremely angry with Lord Curzon.
Yes.
And on the way out, so I'm told, I listened to the debate. And it was very precarious, you see, because we knew the House of Lords was almost solidly entered. The only thing was we'd had a 7-1 majority in the House of Commons. And on the way out, it is alleged, I forget who, probably Mrs. Strachey, because she was always went around with Mrs. Fawcett, that on the way out, Mrs. Humphrey Ward said to Mrs. Fawcett, would you agree even now to a referendum on the subject? And Mrs. Fawcett said, no, certainly not. This is a constitutional decision. And Mrs. Humphrey Ward said, well, then Lord Curzon certainly let us down. And Mrs. Fawcett said, that's what comes of trusting to your men friends. But well, that's true, and what it's very characteristic.
Yes, yes, it's interesting. In fact, did you ever actually go to an anti-meeting?
I went to a debate in the Kensington Town Hall. in which the antis were very strongly represented by, can't remember.
Gladys Pott.
No. No, I don't know. I can't remember. Oh, Mrs. something.
I don't know them well enough, I ought to know.
They had no really distinguished women, you know.
No, though they had a lot of aristocratic women, didn't they? Like Lady Jersey.
Yes, like my cousin, my father's cousin-in-law, Esther. Smith.
Yes. In fact, they are. I mean, because Mrs. Fawcett could get everything she wanted without being active in the vote.
But she was listened to by politicians. She had been since the days of John Stuart Mill.
Yes, her campaign is really purely altruistic from her own
point
of view, really,
altruistic.
Isn't it? I mean,
it's part of her liberalism.
Yeah, she had no need to have the vote to have influence in the system.
No, not at all.
But the antis seem, of course, now to be rather ridiculous, don't they?
Of course, the one member of that family who came out very strongly pro-suffrage was Lady Soborn, the Sissels.
Yes. Do you presume you saw a bit of her because she was active in the NUWS?
She was very active. She was very kind to me as a youngster.
What was she like, really, as a person?
Oh, she was very shrewd. She'd been, her husband, I think, was at one time governor of South Africa, was it?
I think so, yes, before Herbert Gladstone
went
out, I think.
Yes. she was rather ugly, I mean, by conventional standards. And very downright and very kind to me as a youngster because we disagreed about breaking up the poor law. We had correspondence on the subject. I wish I'd kept it.
You mean she wasn't trampling over
your
views?
We met, you see, at one of the Smith, W.H. Smith parties. And because we were about the only two deviationists, suffragists, we came together.
I understand, yes, yes. What is striking is, particularly from the way you talk and the way you wrote in your commonplace book, you're really extremely well connected, the NUWSS people.
Yes.
Is there a case for saying that Mrs. Pankhurst created the WSPU as a way of outmaneuvering women who would inevitably dominate the women's movement if she merely contented herself with joining the NUWSS?
I don't think so, you see. I think she had the mind of a dictator. I mean, she liked dominance for its own sake, partly.
But she had no hope in the NUWSS, did she? I mean,
let's see now what she was doing when she formed the SPU. she was acting as she lost her husband at an early stage, Dr. Bankhurst, who was a great independent Labour Party man.
Mm.
And she was earning the family living as a registrar of births, deaths and marriages, which taught her a lot about family life and the sufferings of women, which I think she really felt. And then at one point, I think she felt her own power.
Mm. You think it's purely, really, a taste for power, really, rather than a jealousy of...
No, I don't think she was jealous of anybody. I don't think she had need to be.
I mean, she's a Lancashire nobody, really, by comparison with Mrs. Fawcett, isn't she? She wouldn't really have got anywhere, would she, by
herself?
No,
she got where she didn't get, on her own personality. She really was. I mean, she could speak in the Albert Hall, Mrs. Fawcett couldn't.
Yes, yes.
I can only remember two women who could speak in the Albert Hall. One was Mrs. Pankhurst, and one was Mrs. Bertrand Russell.
Mrs. Bertrand Russell became an adult suffragist, didn't she? Or at least, Bertrand Russell became an adult suffragist, didn't he?
Bertrand Russell became all sorts of things, and so did his various successive wives.
Yes.
He became, in the end, of course, a great pacifist.
Why didn't you become an adult suffragist?
Oh, I followed the policy of the NU, which was purely practical. If you can get a limited measure, get it. And then go on working for equality.
Hmm. I mean, you're in a sense backing up the antis with everything you say, because they argued, first of all, that fighting for the vote would distract people from social work.
So it did.
And secondly, that votes for women would lead to adult suffrage.
It did. Both of those things were right.
Mm. I mean, the trouble is, when you look at the antis, hitherto they tend to be regarded as rather ridiculous people, but in fact, many of their arguments were quite correct. It's just that...
it was correct to say that they distracted a lot of leading women, active women, from social service. Of course, it did.
Mm.
But there you are. I mean, if social service is what interests them and what they want to get busy about, they've got to get a woman's vote.
Yes, I quite agree with it. It's just that one tends to dismiss all their arguments, whereas in fact some of them...
And you see, at that early point, we regarded the demand for adult suffrage or nothing as a deviationist.
As a sort of blocking measure.
Yes, I know. At the end of the Mud March, which landed us at Exeter Hall, Miss Llewellyn, Margaret Llewellyn Davis, moved an amendment. We were demanding whatever we could get, you see, a measure of women's suffrage. Margaret Llewellyn Davis moved a resolution in favour of committing us to adult suffrage. And there was sort of a bit of a debate on the platform about it. And Margaret Llewellyn Davis was beaten.
Mm. Mrs. Montefiore was attached to the adult suffrage movement as well, wasn't she?
I can't Dora remember.
Montefiore. Yes, I don't know much about her. I must read about her. But anyway, there's no question for you of joining the People's Suffrage Federation or the...
No, I stuck to what I thought was practical.
Yes.
And on what Mrs. Fawcett thought was practical.
Mm.
Get what you can.
Yes. You were actually on the Mud March, were you?
Yes, I was indeed.
I'm just trying to... It was 1907, wasn't it?
1905, I think.
Yes, it was certainly early.
I was a year before I left school, and I left school as early as I possibly could. I must have been between 15 and 16.
Were there many schoolgirls on the march with you?
No.
You...
No.
What? Who led you to join the march? I mean...
The Strachey family. After all, the march was led by Lady Strachey and Mrs. Fawcett.
So it was a family occasion.
And Lady Frances Balfour was a wonderful character.
Yes. Tell me about her, actually.
She looked rather like Queen Elizabeth. She was the first. Was rather like Queen Elizabeth. Very aristocratic, with a great sense of humour. Strange and interesting woman. She lived in Edison Road. I can remember about her.
She was very well connected, of course. Another NWSS
person.
Oh, yes,
of course,
person.
She was very well connected.
And she's always writing about Balfour.
Brother was Duke of Argyll, wasn't he, I think so.
Yes, I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yes.
But she's one of the people I'm thinking of when I say that, in a sense, the NUWSS is hardly anti-government at all, in the sense that it's a part of the government elite, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Of course, all social service movements are.
Yes, yes.
They are. As I say, the only working class movements that don't owe their origin and their progress and their ideas to the... educated middle classes or upper classes are the trade union movement and cooperative consumers' cooperation.
Yes, of course we tend to think of the Labour Party as it before 1914 as it is now. I mean, before 1914 it must have appeared to you as being rather a sort of sectarian working class organisation, not a national party.
Of course it's a grammar school elite.
Yeah, well, yes, but it was certainly not like that then, was it? And so one would not naturally identify oneself as
suffragist. Well, it was within Manchester.
Yes, certainly. But
and they're rather good, the BBC programmes, and rather good about Manchester, because they brought in Miss Roper and Miss Gore Booth.
Yes, I noticed that.
Who led working class women.
Mm. They've rather faded out now, of course, of the programmes, but no doubt they'll come back again with Sylvia.
Yes, they're rather well brought in.
Yes. Did you ever meet Sylvia, actually?
Sylvia Pankhurst?
Yes.
No, I don't think personally, but I've seen her. About
she seems to me rather badly cast in a way. I don't know. I mean, yes. You must tell me what I'm wrong. I mean,
she was really an artist, you know, and trained as an artist. And then afterwards she took up very seriously the cause of Ethiopia when the Italians invaded it.
Mm.
And became afterwards a sort of personality in Ethiopia, and I believe has a statue and a monument in Addis Ababa, where she died.
Yes, very difficult to work with, I believe. I
mean, all Pankhurst, well.
I mean, no good on a committee, for instance. No. She'll always be going off on her own.
No. No.
But,
like Dr. Mary Stopes.
Yes, yes, absolutely, absolutely. But I feel she's too beautiful in the shoulder to shoulder. I mean,
so, yes, I think she probably was.
She's.
And then Adela, who married an Australian seaman, sailor, and went and lived in Australia. I don't think she ever played very much part in the movement.
No.
And a little while ago, a friend of mine who went to Australia was introduced to Adela and referred to her socialist past. But apparently it was not the thing to do, because by that time she'd become a top conservative.
Had she really? Yes, interesting.
And wished to forget.
Yes, very interesting. Well, I don't want to... you see, if I can get the sort of timing of your life right, I mean, as you say, you went on the Mud March as a schoolgirl.
Yes.
You joined the NUWSS, or the LSWS.
Yes.
As...
I used to pay a subscription to it.
Yes.
And get its paper.
Yes. That would be not Common Cause then, would it?
Yes, it was the Common Cause.
Yes.
But later, it became the Woman's Leader, which I edited for...
That's it, yes.
...about 10 years.
So, when actually did you join the LSWS? What, can you remember what... Was it?
I can't remember. Certainly, I was a schoolgirl.
It doesn't matter. You were still a schoolgirl then?
Oh, yes.
Yes. So, what did you do? Did you go to meetings regularly, or what?
Well, I used to go there to sort of whip out in at open-air meetings. They had a lot of open-air meetings. And I used to act as a steward at big meetings.
Did you really?
Yes.
Presumably.
Getting people into their seats and that sort of thing.
I see, yes. Yes.
And on one occasion, when in Edinburgh, I chalked notices on pavement and ran away before the police could tell me not to. It's the nearest I got to any sort of militancy.
Did you ever feel, I'm not saying you should, but did you ever feel guilty at not going to prison?
No, because my parents, you see, I was very much with very disciplined children. And I think one reason why Aunt Edith and Lila, who were militants by affiliation, didn't go to prison was because it was so much upset my grandfather. Although he was himself a very keen suffragist. Mm-hmm. And on one occasion, when Mrs. Pankhurst had announced that she was going to lead a deputation to the House of Commons, and we knew there were going to be peace struggles, he went and they then lived in Russell Square. He went and ordered, to the surprise of my Aunt Edith, who did the housekeeping, a large ham and a cheese to be sent to his office in Great George Street, he being a civil engineer. As a house of rest for tired and exhausted suffragettes.
Goodness me. See, what I wondered was, there must have been a sort of mentality building up that you really weren't working for women unless you were prepared to go to prison for them. And you must have had to resist that sort of feeling, which is quite irrational, in fact.
Well, at one time I would have liked to have gone to prison. And I would have liked to, but my parents wouldn't have let me. They on two occasions I spoke at open-air meetings. And one first occasion, and rather boasted about it. I think I probably did it rather well. And I was told never to do it again. I did it once again, but never after that.
But just because it's not somebody of your class just shouldn't speak in public, in the open air?
No, I was regarded as too young, that sort of thing.
Mm.
Too young.
Mm.
Oh, no, they all spoke in the open air, all right.
I see, it was just that they wanted you to get on with either
yes,
your school
work.
Yes,
I was still at school.
Mm. Mm. But when you left school, you went into this school, I can't quite remember the word for it.
I had 2 years of social work between... leaving school, and I was only too anxious to leave school because it didn't interest me at all. And then I found that there was the thing I was interested in was economics. And the only thing I ever did at school that interested me was literature. I thought I could do that anyhow by myself. And so I think so too. But then I had 2 years of social work. And then suddenly I found, I think I put that in my commonplace book, that there was a place in London called the School of Economics where you could study as an undergraduate all the things that interested me. And in those days, there was no competitive exam. All I had to do was to pick up the necessary matriculation subjects.
And you were in.
And I was in.
But can you say that your 2 years of social work, it was, after all, a very impressionable period of your life,
did
you think? Did that affect your attitude to women's position at all?
Well, I think everything affected and still does when I see women put upon.
Mm.
Still does.
But of course, you were a suffragist before you got involved in this social work. It merely probably
yes,
accentuated
at school.
Yes. I mean, you don't say very much about your social work experience in your commonplace book, actually.
No, I was on a care committee, and I think that in a way, two people were, so to speak, fighting for me. One was Octavia Hill, who gave me a book of her collected papers and said I might like to see something of her work. She would have liked me as a rent collector. And then on the other hand, you see, was the care committee system, which was just developing.
And, which is the antithesis of what Octavia...
Which is the antithesis, and which caused me once, mistakenly, to argue with Octavia Hill. I think I gave the course of that argument. And the moral was, don't attempt to argue with Octavia Hill when you are 15.
What exactly was her manner when you argued with her? I mean...
Now just turn.
She was a difficult woman, wasn't she?
Yes.
When she was old.
Well, of course, she lived with two other old ladies, Miss Sim and the Marylebone Road. Miss Sim, who did the housekeeping and was of no great distinction, and a rather younger woman called Miss Harriet York, who put a lot of money into her rent collecting and was, I think, very much a colleague of Octavia Hill. And then there was a charming old sister who ran a thing called the Curl Society.
Miranda.
What? Miranda.
Miranda, yes.
The sort of soft and gentle one. And who sort of organised these extremely austere tea parties so that everybody got an audience of Miss Octavia.
She was almost like Lady Frances Balfour, a sort of Queen Elizabeth figure, again, Octavia, wasn't she?
She was, rather, yes.
I mean, very grand. And
oh, very grand, yes.
But
I think Sargent's picture does her more than justice.
Yes, she looks really rather beautiful in that, but she
wasn't.
Yes,
she wasn't
beautiful
at all. She was very short and dressed in very curious sort of loose sleeves. And sometimes you felt she might be a short woman sitting down, standing up, and not a big woman sitting down, you know.
It was all sort of...
Yes.
But how did you ever come to be introduced to Octavia at the age of 15? I mean...
I had an aunt who refused to join... my father's three sisters they were not active aunties, but they never would play a part in the suffrage movement, and we regretted it because they were very intelligent women. And one of them, my Aunt Marion, trained as a hospital nurse at the Middlesex Hospital, though she did practice for a bit, but not much. And then she took to social work, and she did the war savings, and she went on the Kensington Borough Council, and she was in contact with Miss Hill's friends.
Yes.
And it was she who took me to tea with Miss Octavia.
What was it like?
What, the tea?
Mm.
Bloody. Almost as bad as Mrs. Sidney Webb's dinners.
Mm. So presumably purely personality factors influenced you against...
I felt very proud and very grand going to tea with Miss Octavia, and I shouldn't have tried to argue with her.
Anyway, you were converted by the other party, so
yes,
speak.
I was. And the leading converter to me was my grandfather's relative, who was one of the Strachey family, Margie Freer, who started care committees and who was a member of the LCC Education Committee and was, I think, responsible for the inquiry into the health of schoolchildren, which led to school feeding.
Was she an auntie, actually?
Is what?
Was she an auntie?
No.
I'm just trying to remember. There were some Freers who were aunties, I think.
I don't know.
Maybe I'm wrong on that. Anyway.
Anyway, she wasn't an auntie.
Mm. So that tempted you into childcare,
schoolwork. And you see, then in connection with my aunt's convalescent home for children, and Lila Rendell's work among children, and the care committee secretaryship was a very attractive job.
Why, actually?
Well, I'd been secretary of the committee, and it made me feel very important. I wasn't allowed to do the actual visiting, because my mother thought, and rightly, that for a 15-year-old girl to investigate cases of middle-aged women was rather impertinent. But I did all the secretarial work, and I had to edit, and to some extent, the rather untidy case records of members of the committee. And I had to prepare the agendas.
So you were sort of backup for the whole...
I had to write the minutes, keep the minutes, correspond with the LCC care subcommittee, or whatever it was called, of the Education Committee, and all that prompted by Miss Margie Freer.
But what was this seen as leading to by your parents? I mean, maybe it wasn't seen as leading
to... Not leading to anything much, I don't know. Mm. I think at one point they wanted me to come out, but I went back again.
And much more interesting than coming out.
Yes.
But
if they wanted me to get married, I dealt with that myself quite efficiently.
But... in fact, you did this work, and presumably that interested you more in economics and economic questions.
Yes, it did indeed.
How you say you didn't actually interview the women involved,
no.
So how did it affect you, just by reading their cases?
Oh, well, all their cases I had to read, all their cases I had to get to know how they lived and the sort of wages they lived on. It was extremely interesting. And I had to keep in touch with the headmistress and the people who were put on the free feeding list.
Yes, if I can just sort of recap on what happened. It's a question of who gets free meals at school, isn't it?
But in those days... They were selected.
Mm.
And then it was borne in on us that in Bradford it was free for all.
Mm.
But not in London.
Mm.
You had to check up who really needed it.
So So that involved sending sort of social workers, as we now call them, round to each individual house to just look at...
Well, members of the care committee went round and summarised what they saw. And then if there were difficulties, there were in those days two care committee organisers, the whole army of them now.
Yes, so you're really, in a sense, coordinating or acting as the...
doing the secretariat.
Yes, for these people who are doing the visiting.
And corresponding on official note paper, which made me feel very grand, with Mr. Robert Blair, who was the education officer, and who signed himself your obedient servant. Though, in fact, he was nobody's obedient servant, at least of all mine.
But were there any suffragists actually among the care committee people?
Oh, there were members. Yeah. Well, of course, my Aunt Elsie Rendall was nominally a suffragist, though she didn't do any work. No, I don't think there were, as far as I remember that particular care committee.
Mm. So it doesn't really push you any further into the women's movement, rather away from it to some extent.
Well, I suppose so. I mean, it was the sort of thing I wanted to do, which was the kind of work that Rendalls were doing all over the place.
Mm. Yes, in a way, you seem to be in the same sort of situation as Beatrice Webb in the 1880s. I mean, you're looking round...
Ah, but I didn't think like Beatrice Webb, because, you see, there were all sorts of other interests impinging on me all the time, whereas her mind was entirely departmental.
Mm.
She wouldn't think about family alliances,
mm.
because it was a distraction. She was wrong, in fact.
Mm. Yes, now, I really meant that you're moving the same sort of social work circles as she moved in the 1880s. It's good works by middle-class girls, isn't it?
Well, of course, she had to fight with her parents, didn't she, as far as I remember?
Yes, she did, yes.
With her autobiography.
Yes. Whereas your parents didn't...
They wanted her to come out like her sisters.
Mm. Whereas your parents suggested it, but didn't insist on coming out.
No, well, I'd had a coming out ball.
Did you?
It caused me much distress, but it was held at the Goupil Gallery, and it was in aid of my Aunt Edith's girls' club. And I had a white dress, which I felt very uncomfortable in, and there was a loan collection on at the time in the Goupil Gallery, and as I was waltzed round with successive partners, I saw that picture.
Oh, yes.
I thought to myself, that's the man I'll marry. And I did.
Yes, yes. Anyway, it was love at first sight in your case, wasn't it?
No, it was love at first sight in his case. God knows how he managed it, just as I was then. And I took several weeks to make up my mind, and he followed me along to West Bay, where he lived in, made his invalid brother live in very uncomfortable lodgings, and pursued his suit. And that was that. It was a very careful piece of matchmaking by Mrs. Sidney Ball of Oxford.
Yes, let's move to Oxford, can we? Or would you rather stop now?
Yes, move to Oxford.
I mean, because you married in 1913, I think, or thereabouts.
Yes, I did. I was engaged for quite a time.
Yes, for about a year while you were there.
And I finished my degree.
Yes, but presumably you went along to NUWSS meetings a bit,
of course,
did you? All the time.
All
really,
the time.
While you were at the
so did my husband. He was a very active member of the Oxford Women's Suffrage Society.
Was he?
With Professor Gildart.
Tell me about Gildart. He's a prominent figure, actually,
oh,
in
really?
The local,
yes.
local organisation. He was a professor, wasn't
yes,
he?
Yes, he was.
What sort of person was he?
He was a large, white-haired man. He married a sister of a Miss Falk. And she was, of course, very active in the suffrage movement. So was Professor Gildart, so was Gilbert Murray.
Mm. There's also a person, I can't pronounce it, called Margoliouth, is it? Or Margoliouth?
Margoliouth.
Yes.
Margoliouth was a professor, a person. And he... he married a student, and his pupils wanted to give him a tribute of affection on his marriage and ask what he would, or a tribute of affection on his 50th birthday or something of the sort, ask what he would like. And he said he would like a typewriter with Arabic script. And then, before they'd ordered this thing to be made, they had a letter from Margoliouth to say, "Do not bother about Arabic typewriter. I'm going to marry Miss Bain Smith." And thereafter they did marry. And they lived a very strange life, because in order to avoid housekeeping, they put their servants on board wages and were, so to speak, lodgers in their own house.
He was married at the time when you were in Oxford.
Yes, he was.
Yes, yes. Can you generalise about the type of people who, in the university, joined the local NUWSS branch? I mean, is it possible to generalise, do you think?
Well, I mean, all good liberals naturally would.
Mm.
It's quite a strong branch. Very strong branch.
Yes.
Had some very good public meetings. There was a very good public man called Councillor Hall who backed it.
There were two branches. The Amalgamated University and Town branch, was it? Or?
I think it was only one branch, yes. The Oxford branch of the NUWSS.
Mm. So when you were married and you went to live in Oxford,
yes.
You went to a few Oxford meetings?
Of course.
Did you?
Yes.
What sort of things did you do there? You just attended meetings, really, did you?
Well, by that time, I was on the executive, and I used to, I think, come down to London for it.
Mm, I see, yes. So you were really sort of a larger star, in a sense. Than
very much just, in it, yes. And my husband took the opportunity, when he being in that year of his marriage, junior proctor, and junior proctors have the privilege of introducing statutes, and he introduced the statute to make women members of the university.
Yes,
and of course,
yes.
It was all put into cold storage during the war.
During the war, yes. Yes. That must have been a rather courageous thing to do, actually.
Well,
at that
indeed,
time.
He was a courageous man.
Yes, yes. Was he a member of the local NUWSS branch before he married you?
Oh, yes.
all the time under the influence of people like Gilbert and Gilbert Murray. Certainly.
Sidney Ball, because I went to
and Sidney Ball, of course.
I'm a St. John's man myself.
Yes, well, Sidney Ball was.
He was a keen suffragist, wasn't he?
Very keen.
There's a biography of him, isn't there, by Una
Ball? By his wife, yes.
Yes. Was he keen on women's suffrage as a mainline?
Oh, yes, he really was, certainly was. He certainly was. If you want to read the story of why Sidney Ball was not made president of St. John's College, get that book by C.P. Snow called The Masters.
The Masters, yes.
It's all
there.
Exactly the same. and Mrs. Ball, you see, played the same part as that wife. I mean, St. John's College just would not have Mrs. Sidney Ball in the president's lodging.
Interesting. Did you try to make recruits for women's suffrage by speaking in public in Oxford?
Oh, yes. We've always tried to make recruits for women's suffrage.
I mean, open-air meetings, or...?
I can't remember open-air meetings in Oxford until the Irish question. But we were very politically minded. But we didn't destroy property or have demonstrations.
Oh, no. There was some destruction of property locally, wasn't there, actually, by suffragettes?
I think they had an outburst in Oxford. I don't really remember.
There was also a union debate, wasn't there, on women's suffrage, in which Harold Macmillan spoke.
I'd forgotten that.
I think, in 1913.
I'd forgotten that.
He spoke in favour of women's suffrage.
Yes,
I think Walter Monckton was against. I imagine your main business when you were in Oxford was simply setting up house. I mean, you
and going up to London to
attend
meetings of the executive. And,
yes.
And I was also starting to do a postgraduate piece of research for a further degree on the history, early history of coal mining.
Did you?
So I spent quite a lot of time looking at documents in the Bodleian.
I see, yes.
But all that came to an end with the war and the other things to do.
Yes.
And I never resumed it.
You never finished
it. But I had voluminous notes on the early history of coal mining. And when I got to Lancashire, I found I knew quite a lot about it.
Yes, very useful later, I think, in your lecturing.
Yes.
But, there seems to be a slightly sort of equivocal attitude on the part of the heads of women's colleges to women's suffrage activity, really.
Well, I don't, as far as I remember, they were all grown.
I mean, they don't want their girls to become suffragettes. They want them to become suffragists, if anything, don't they?
Well, they didn't want them. They didn't want disorder or like it in any form.
No. And there's a problem, really, isn't, as far as they're concerned. They're fighting for position in Oxford.
Yes, indeed.
And so, obviously, they
behave very well.
They have to behave like good girls.
Of course,
in order
and like ladies. And chaste ladies.
That's the problem, isn't it, really, for them? I mean,
well, it wasn't as much a problem as it is now. Of course, now you have to have a psychiatrist attached.
Yes.
To every university or place of education to deal with emotional upsets of women who think they're not desirable and men who doubt their manhood.
Yes, well, that clearly life was simpler in some ways.
Yes,
because in a sense you put off sex, don't you, until later in life, really.
Well, you see, when I was engaged.
I don't mean you personally, I mean everybody did.
Yes. When I was engaged for about 18 months, really, there was no question of premarital intercourse. One just didn't do that sort of thing. Now, you'd be all the time, people would be asking what you were doing about it and whether you were miserable. We weren't miserable, we were very happy.
Yes, of course.
We did all sorts of things together every weekend.
Yes.
And we were interested in our work, you see, that so few people are nowadays.
What happened to women's suffrage in Oxford when the war broke out then?
Everything died down in Oxford, didn't it? First of all, broke out and they housed officer training corps and that sort of thing.
It all
went dead.
Yes. I wonder, I'm tempted to...
Anti-suffrage students tried to break it up. Mrs. Margoliouth was in the middle of it. And somebody heard her say in the middle of this early burly, "Oh, Mr. So-and-so, don't let me introduce you to my personal friend."
I made a list, actually, of the Oxford people. I'm just trying to think, see if I can find it. Margoliouth, yeah, Sidney Ball, Geldart. John Massey was a prominent anti. Did you ever come across
him? Oh, no, I don't remember him as a prominent anti, but the man who really fought to the death against giving women degrees was Atkinson of Exeter.
Oh, yes, he's still a legendary figure in Oxford,
yes.
Actually. I mean, he hated women at his lectures.
He did, yes, like a very strange man.
Yes, but the antis were quite well organised in Oxford, as far as I can
there
see.
There was an organisation, yes, and they did on one occasion attempt to break up the meeting. When the procession went through, I think it was one of the...
Oh, this would be the 1913 pilgrimage,
that's
it,
yes.
Yes.
They tried to break that up.
Did you actually join the pilgrimage?
Yes, we did. We joined the pilgrimage in Oxford, and we marched with it somewhere down into the Chilterns, and then I had to get home, because I was part of work in the School of Economics, preparing for finals.
You had a visit, and if you really...